Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie, brought to you by Killer Podcasts, an Evergreen Podcasts network. I'm the titular Sean.
And I'm the very titular Carrie.
It's the show that takes you inside the unbelievable, the unexplainable, the macabre, and the bizarre, and tries to find an answer. Hello, Caroline.
Hello.
Listeners, we're bringing you, I'm going to say a shorter episode, although if you look at the, if you saw the time on this episode and it looks like a normal one, then never mind. I prepared an appropriate amount. We've been very, very busy. We don't want to miss a week, but we have been very strapped for time with all our sort of library tour of Connecticut and Massachusetts recently.
Yeah, so at least, it's podcast related.
Yeah, it is our busy season for this stuff. So, we have been lucky enough to have a lot of interest in programs on aliens and ghosts in this, especially around Halloween. So we've been doing a lot of traveling, Carrie. We've been doing a lot of just telling spooky stories, meeting people out on the road, trying to, in some cases, explain what podcasts are and how you can find them. If any of you found us, welcome.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
And so I guess what I want to do this week is, this week we did a presentation on colonial ghost stories, and like all of our sort of live shows, Carrie, all of our library presentations, to be more accurate,
yes.
It is a combination of stories we've already told on the show and some sort of new things that we researched just for this presentation. So I wanted to give all of you fine people a little peek at what you could be seeing if you can make it out to one of these library shows. I know people are listening from all over the world, but if you happen to be near...
You know that?
I do. I see the statistics. South Korea. We see you, South Korea.
Yes.
Two...
All two of you in South Korea.
Two South Korean listeners. five English listeners. We love these people.
Absolutely.
They're probably not going to come see us at a public library, although they're welcome. But if you're a little closer, we've had some listeners drive distances to come and see us, and it's felt great.
The furthest I think that anyone's come to see us is our listener Delaney came from Massachusetts to Connecticut to come and see just one of our random weeknight library presentations, which was wild. It was so nice. And she made us like Taylor Swift Eras Tour style little bracelets. One says titular and one says very titular. I'll let you guess who was wearing what. I have barely taken it off since I got it. It was so nice.
We're both wearing them right now. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And, we had a listener bring us a movie of his at a recent library presentation, which I think we mentioned before. We had our listener, Pete, bring some toys for Poe because he works at a pet supply store and came to one of the things. So you don't have to, bring us tribute every time, but, just knowing that, listeners knowing that we have a dog. Or knowing the whole titular thing is just crazy to us, and it's cool.
Knowing that we love watching horror movies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Making them, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's been really awesome meeting more of you, especially in the most wonderful time of the year. And hopefully we can actually do some, live recordings or something sometime. So, we don't always have to be at a library, but as two avowed nerds, Both of us basically grew up at libraries. So
accurate.
It's been fun to bring the vibes there.
Absolutely. And so what I want to do, Caroline, is give a little bit of this colonial ghost material that's been in some of our recent presentations. And, you know, if you're nearby, come out and see us. And we would we'd love to give you a big old hug or a handshake, whatever you're comfortable with in these COVID times. I guess maybe a fist bump.
Yeah, maybe. One of those elbow things.
Eskimo kisses? What are we doing?
I think Eskimo kisses is
about
too
as bad.
Much.
About as bad as you can do.
Yeah.
this is a little bit of what you can hear in our live shows.
Library presentations.
So colonial ghosts, Carrie, and we're going to start with a pre-revolutionary, well, I guess these are all colonial, right? It has to be pre-revolutionary or revolutionary.
Sure.
But our listeners have already, or if they haven't, they can go back and hear us talk at length about both cannibalism at Jamestown and the Croatoan Roanoke disappearance.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Which are creepy stories from the origins of our country, pre-colonial ghost stories. You can go listen to those episodes.
There's also plenty of Salem witch trial stuff.
Plenty of Salem witch trial stuff. That's another thing we talk about in this show. But then, another pre-revolutionary ghost story, a ghost ship even, is the so-called Palatine Light that can be seen racing by in green flames off the coast of Block Island.
Oh, okay.
Which is off of Rhode Island, if anybody isn't from around here. So yeah, Block Island wasn't always kind of the hip weekend summer vacation destination that it is today. And in fact, there were pretty strained relations between Block Islanders and mainlanders, apparently, in, say, the 18th century when this story takes place.
Why is that?
Well, A, it was a place you kind of wanted to avoid anyway. Block Island is surrounded by these super rocky shoals, sharp rocks that will puncture the bottom of any ship trying to come into port, especially a big wooden ship like you'd be traveling in, say, 1738.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty dangerous place. If you didn't know exactly what way you were supposed to be going, a pretty dangerous place to try to dock anyway. But mainlanders also had a pretty unfavorable opinion, reputation, I don't know, of Block Islanders. There were rumors that they were not only unfriendly, but sometimes murderous to outsiders. They may even try to lure you ashore onto those rocky shoals with a false lighthouse or some other kind of trick and, you know, kill you and take all your stuff.
Classic false lighthouse.
Listen, it's not done as much anymore.
No?
It used to be a classic pirate move.
Okay.
So those shoals around Block Island became the graveyard of the Princess Augusta in 1738. She was a 220-ton English ship. And she had 240 German immigrants aboard who were headed for Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
It had already been a terrible trip before the shipwreck we're about to describe. Disease had killed, there were 240 passengers aboard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Disease had killed 200 of them or more.
Mm.
And half the crew, the 14-man crew, including Captain George Long, were also dead.
Mm.
And so the ship was now in command of the first mate, a guy named Andrew Brooke, who didn't apparently do a great job because instead of ending up in Philadelphia, they ended up somewhere in the neighborhood of Rhode Island.
Yeah, that's not close.
And the Augusta was damaged and leaking by the time it reached Block Island, where obviously it wrecked on the shoals.
Mm-hmm.
So as the ship began to sink, the account that's come down to us through history is that this Andrew Brooke, this first mate, jumped into all the lifeboats on board with his crew and rowed ashore, kind of calling to the last surviving passengers, like, we'll come back for you guys, don't worry. And then just didn't make any effort to do so. And then apparently it was the Block Islanders, counter to their unfriendly, you know, murderous reputation from outsiders, who either launched a major rescue effort to help the people still aboard, or just made Brooke get his ass back out there and bring them.
Well, I hope that he went down in history as like a miserable coward or whatever. What a horrible thing to do.
I think he's mostly forgotten.
Fair enough.
He's usually name-checked when you read this story, but sometimes it's just as Brooke. So he's not like a famous sailor or anything like that. No hero mariner here.
Well, certainly not.
And so the Block Islanders may also have buried one or two dozen of the deceased who were still aboard.
Wow.
It is said in some versions of the story that one woman was left behind. Her name might have been Mary Vanderline, or that might have been made up somewhere along the line. But
left behind?
Left behind, forgotten, or, depending on the story, driven mad by the suffering so far aboard the ship. Remember, this is journeys across the Atlantic in 1738 were terrible no matter what.
Yeah.
But this is one where you got lost, there wasn't enough food or water, the water got contaminated, everyone got sick, all of your family died. And so this Mary Vanderline apparently was just, just kind of catatonic or otherwise crazed by her grief.
Mm-hmm.
Or else they just forgot her. And so Mary Vanderline was supposedly, or whatever this woman's name was, could supposedly be heard wailing as the ship went down, the last remaining person aboard.
So, do you hear her wailing if you see the ghost ship?
That is part of the legend, Carrie. So, yes, fascinating. People do see a blazing green ghost ship blazing past Block Island. Often on the Saturday between Christmas and New Year's.
Was that when it sank?
No, it sank in August, I think.
So, weird. I've never heard of a haunting like that.
Maybe he
comes back every day on the anniversary of his death, or every year on the anniversary of his death. I've never heard of like a specific, I don't know, Saturday before New Year's. It's just crazy to me.
Well, I might point out that like the aurora is also seen more in the winter, right? And that's a green like effect in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if it's a similar visual effect that people are seeing, then could be.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that usually after the New Year? Or am I just,
I don't know,
out of my head?
I thought it was just cold times of the year.
I know the aurora is usually in Norway because we want to go see it in like February-ish, March-ish.
You got to be north above the Arctic Circle in a perfect world.
Yeah, so I don't know. Would it be around in December? Maybe. I ain't a scientist.
Yeah, I know, but if you're in Scandinavia in the summer, you're not going to see it.
Right.
But in the dead of winter, you got a better shot.
Hmm.
It's not after. I don't think it's after New Year's, though, specifically.
Okay.
Because I've seen it in November.
Ugh, lucky.
Now, the Princess Augusta wreck inspired, or maybe more accurately, was fictionalized in a poem by this guy named John Greenleaf Whittier.
Greenleaf.
Called the Palatine. The ship was, it's named the Palatine in the poem, but the poem's obviously referring to this incident. And at the time, in contemporary accounts, people refer to it as the Palatine ship after the shipwreck, because all the people who died on the ship were from a region of Germany called the Palatine.
Okay. Fair enough.
Just to catch you up on the name. In the poem, the Palatine, the wicked residents of Block Island lure the hapless ship onto the rocks with a false lighthouse.
Oh, no.
So they can murder and rob the passengers and crew.
Well, that's a hell of a way to thank people who stuck their necks out to try and save these people.
Just like the old story.
Oh, well, that stinks. No wonder the Block Islanders didn't like other people.
And that murderous version of the story does make a sort of ghost apparition make a lot more sense. Because
maybe of, I don't know,
because of the like horror of the
Brooke just left them all to die, so it's not like that different. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to demonize the Block Islanders.
Well, the poem in any case did bring the Princess Augusta wreck back into the public consciousness, if under the wrong name.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why it wasn't until the publication of that poem in 1867 that people started reporting seeing the Palatine Light.
They never reported it before then?
No. Arguments about which way this story went started about a week in, or started about a year after the wreck. So then there were already mainlanders saying the Block Islanders had lured the hapless ship onto the rocks, and Block Islanders saying, no, we heroically defended the people.
Mm-hmm.
So those stories split a year after the wreck, but it wasn't until 1867. I've never seen accounts before 1867 of the ghost ship.
Okay.
When the ghost ship is seen, it is sometimes accompanied by the wailing of a lone woman. Perhaps that poor, poor Mary Vanderline.
Hmm.
And again, if you want to go try to see this thing, I guess, apparently it's the Saturday between Christmas and New Year's. So there you go.
So weird.
That's the Palatine Light, Caroline. What do you think of that?
Well, we love a ghost ship, though we don't love these circumstances.
Correct. And listener, if you're a new listener, and I hope you are, we...
No, we hope you're listening at whatever time is good for you.
We did a whole episode, a whole two episodes on ghost ships.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage you to go back and check that out. I think it's a lot of really creepy stories and some very sad ones.
Yay.
I think we saved the Tenmouth Electron for Patreon. That's a real bummer.
Yeah, talk about the hubris of man.
Oh, yeah. What was that guy's name? I forget, but he was made of hubris, the Tenmouth Electron guy.
Yeah.
Very sad. Look it up.
Or don't.
If you
look up something happy.
Yeah, I mean, you could subscribe on Patreon. You could come hear us tell you about
it. Yeah, that's a good middle ground.
Carrie, I'm starting to think we're going to be fine on normal episode time at this point, actually. Let's move along to Ghosts of the Revolution.
Ooh.
And it makes sense that there's a lot of Revolutionary War ghost stories, right? It's arguably the most important event in the history of our country because it's when it started.
Certainly one of them. And we know from our Gettysburg Ghosts episode that battlefields and wars, especially fought on your own land, are always going to be, I guess, magnets for spirit activity, if you believe in that, of course, Sean.
Well, they create a lot of ghosts because a lot of people die.
Great way to look at it.
And in the 7 years of the revolution, there's also this kind of huge emotional upheaval overturning as people shift their allegiance from one country to a totally made up new one.
Or don't. I mean, when it came to the Civil War, we had brother fighting against brother, North versus South. And there was some of that in the Revolution because not only were people fighting, you know, British soldiers from overseas, there were also loyalists fighting rebels and all that. And like, you know, the colonists trying to establish America versus the people that just wanted to kind of keep the status quo. So there's a lot of like, you might be fighting your neighbor at certain times. And that's certainly always going to be fraught emotionally.
Yeah, 100%. Now, much of the early violence of the revolution took place in and around New York City, including brutal fighting along the East River.
And for a little more on that, we've got Horrors of the American Revolution that we just came out with this summer.
I truly thought you were going to say, for more on that, check out Act One of Hamilton.
Also that.
Well, more than 6,000 Patriot soldiers and militiamen would ultimately die fighting the British. As many as twice that number, Carrie, might have died in the awful conditions aboard British prison ships.
Oof.
And many of those were anchored right along the East River, Which in certain stretches can feel like a prison today.
So you're saying that a ship in the 1700s is probably one of the worst places to be, but somehow a prison ship in the 1700s could be even worse.
It definitely was worse. Mm. I mean, that Princess Augusta situation is a special situation, but this is way worse than most 1700s pleasure cruises.
Mm-hmm.
Prisoners would be crowded together in dark, dank ship holds. They would be drinking river water that just kind of leaked through the side of the ship.
Oh, God.
And they were continuously ravaged by lice, mice, and infectious diseases that obviously, just like the Princess Augusta, would spread like wildfire because everyone's just kind of pissing and shitting where they are. There's no other way to say it.
Right, and the East River isn't even the East River at this time. You know, it's not like a polluted wasteland.
No, they made it that way.
Well, they certainly helped.
When a man died in these conditions, and that, you know, it happened, obviously.
I'm sure, yeah.
He would generally just be tipped overboard.
God.
So for many years after the war, decades, bleached bones would wash up frequently on the Brooklyn side of the East River, like way more than you would think.
That's very ghoulish.
And many of those bones, you love beachcombing, by the way, Carrie. What a nice surprise that would be.
I've only ever found a few bones, and they're certainly animal. I couldn't imagine coming across like a huge shin bone or something.
A POW's jaw.
Oh, God. Those poor, poor people.
Many of the ones that washed up on the banks of the river over the years are now interred at the Prison Ship Martyrs Monument, which you can go to at Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn.
That sounds intense.
It's a big old tower. If you go to Fort Greene Park, you can't miss it. It's the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm.
Connecticut's Robert Sheffield said this of his imprisonment.
Bobby Sheffs?
Oh, yeah. You know Bobby. The heat was so intense that the hot sun shining all day on deck, they were all naked, which also served the well to get rid of vermin. But the sick were eaten up alive.
Mm.
Their sickly countenances and ghastly looks were truly horrible. Some swearing and blaspheming, others crying, praying, and wringing their hands, and stalking about like ghosts. Others delirious, raving, and storming, all panting for breath, some dead and corrupting.
Oh, what a visceral way to put that.
The air was so foul that at times a lamp could not be kept burning. By reason of which, the bodies were not missed until they had been bedead 10 days.
Oh, God. And you're just all in with that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because there's not enough oxygen. What that means that you can't keep a candle lit is there's not enough oxygen in the air to feed the fire. Because so much of the air is like methane and other human body gases.
Oh, my God. Ugh, Jesus. That actually made me nauseous.
Yeah, it's really fucked up.
Yeah.
So the British abandoned and burned the ship during their flight from New York at the end of the war. And it would lay there at the bottom of the river until it was accidentally turned up by laborers who were building the Brooklyn Navy Shipyard in 1902.
Mm-hmm.
And crew's tools actually punctured the hull of this ship they didn't know was down there.
Mm.
And so maybe they disturbed the dead, but ever since, people taking an evening stroll along the East River have occasionally reported...
casual East River evening stroll.
Now listen, there's not that many places to... Never mind. I was going to say there's not that many places to see water in New York, but it's an island. but taking an evening stroll by the East River, people do report desperate whispers as they get close to that Navy shipyard. Now, by the time the Revolution began, Carrie, Boston was under full occupation, military... martial law by the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
And British soldiers were apparently known to use the monuments and the headstones in Copse Hill Cemetery in Boston for target practice.
Okay. It's like the Patriot. Like, they're just kind of swanning around with their prison ships, shooting up tombstones.
Like, impossibly, cartoonishly evil. Right. Sort of mustache.
They're twirling. All Jason Isaacs.
A monument to your dead loved one.
Yeah. Like, okay, we get it. You're British.
There's a dented weather vane on the top of the First Congregational Church of Stratford that... town legend is that Redcoats used that for target practice. I don't know if it's true or not.
Oh, I never knew that.
Now, the disrespect those Redcoats showed to those headstones in Copse Hill Cemetery may be part of the reason why it is similar to our own Union Cemetery in Easton, Kerry. Mm-hmm. It is often cited as one of the most haunted cemeteries in the country. And there are superstitious Bostonians who avoid the site.
There are superstitious Bostonians?
Hey, I'm fucking scared over here. Nope, that's New York. I'm fucking scared. I'm so fucking scared over here.
Very nice. I just want to remind you of the curse of the Bambino. It was a good time.
In this case, the curse of the Bambino is fucking. Copse Hill is, it's known as one of the most haunted cemeteries in the country, and people report hearing muffled cries or strange groans as they walk past the stones.
Where's the Duncan? Blah.
Or even see strange lights or shadowy figures moving around inside after dark. Kerry, I'll remind you, we have a lot of listeners in Massachusetts.
I was going to say, it's just Ben Affleck. I'm sorry. My family's from the Bronx. It's all in love.
Well, we're staying.
I married Sean, after all. It's like one of those, you know, royal alliances between France and England or whatever. It's mutually assured destruction.
I'm also not from Massachusetts.
Your family is, and you're all Red Sox fans. It's the same thing.
All right, you hear that, Massachusetts listeners? I am your champion.
You know I love Massachusetts.
And those Massachusetts listeners can also find some ghosts at Concord's Colonial Inn, as I'm sure they know and have heard ad nauseum at this point. But for the rest of you, the Colonial Inn had a front row seat for the skirmish that filled over from nearby Lexington to kick off the bloody violence of the Revolution. It was first built in 1716, but the inn would become a stockpile for weapons and ammo for the colonial forces, the militia, definitely the militia and maybe the regular colonial army during the early phases of the war, as well as a makeshift hospital, Kerry, for the injured and dying, both in that first initial skirmish and at times throughout the war. You can imagine really intense emotions. We've talked about this in, say, our Gettysburg episode, but an early modern battlefield is a really horrible place, and if you get injured in a limb, there's a good chance someone's just going to be sawing that thing off, and that's what a hospital is.
You're going
is.
In raw. You're getting maybe, well, it's certainly in the Revolutionary era, you're getting like some alcohol, but they don't really even have like laudanum or anything, right?
Nope.
So,
just a lot of screams, a lot of biting belts, I think.
God.
So you can imagine that all that energy would leave an impression behind. It's said that you can stay in room 24, which is the former hospital. It's where they actually were sawing these guys' legs off on tables and stuff.
How romantic.
And that's where the best chances of sort of paranormal activity are. And guests report lights and TVs flickering on and off, hearing voices, obviously, always, and, seeing orbs.
Now, just a shout out to any haunted hotels, inns, motels, Airbnbs, B&Bs, etc. If you're listening, we're totally down to come and do like a live episode from your most haunted room. 1408 styles until we go completely insane. And then won't that make a great episode?
Oh, can we?
I don't know. Hotels, B&Bs, Airbnbs, etc. Get at us.
The Colonial Inn is also home to Rosemary, a misty white, translucent woman who's been seen gliding down hallways and hovering around rooms, Rosemary's believed to be a nurse who maybe saw to the wounded during the war in room 24, perhaps.
Mm.
And while the violence of those early skirmishes and later battles would claim a lot of lives in the Revolution, a lot of people just died from infection or hunger or, in some cases, the cold, because there were some really bad winter encampments for Washington's army. And one of the most famous bad winters in history has to be the one that the Continental Army boys settled down for at Valley Forge.
Well, we talked a lot about that in Horrors of the American Revolution.
Yes, we did, where, of course, 2,000 Americans, just to remind you, would die of disease alone in that winter,
mm-hmm.
with more succumbing to malnutrition or just straight-up frostbite all over.
Mm-hmm.
There's famous stories that you've heard before from us, perhaps, of men boiling and eating their shoe leather, catching rats to eat. Now let's talk about the ghosts of Valley Forge. Not starting right after the Revolution, but starting in the late 1800s, when the Victorians started being really fascinated with paranormal stuff.
Victorians, you gotta love them.
They loved spiritualism, and right around the time that the mediums were setting up crystal balls in people's drawing rooms all over England and America, people started reporting ghostly campfires and veiled orbs hovering around the site of the old Valley Forge camp.
I would have had so much fun in the spiritualism era.
I know you would have.
I mean, I wouldn't have been able to vote, but...
That's more fun in a way.
Says the 30-something white man. Have you ever not had the ability to vote?
No, but I've gotten no joy out of following politics.
Oh, boo-hoo.
Now, the interesting thing with those Valley Forge ghosts, sometimes people would report seeing groups of men huddled around what they assumed were mass graves, and then when it was reported that bones had been found at the site, it was like, oh my god, there really were mass graves, so you make connections between those stories. It was a really cool time for, like, amateur ghost hunters and ghost theorists.
Mm-hmm.
But then it turned out that their historical records indicate there probably weren't any mass graves at Valley Forge. And the bones that have been found are all from pigs, chickens, and cows. But maybe it's their ghosts that haunt the site.
Can you imagine a chicken ghost?
Yeah, it's probably a translucent chicken.
That's just a crazy thought.
Now, 2 years after Valley Forge, the Jockey Hollow encampment in North Jersey for winter 1779 was way worse, apparently. There were 28 separate snowstorms dropping 15-foot drifts on the army.
Jesus, 28.
That's like some alive shit, some like Uruguayan rugby team stuff.
Yeah.
You can visit the site at the Morristown National Historical Park, and visitors and hikers report ghostly crap almost more than at Valley Forge over there.
Hey, there's ghostly crap here.
Hey, look at all this ghostly crap. People hear snatches of fife and drum music, and then they'll turn to see where it's coming from and see a glimpse of colonial soldiers. How cool would this be? A glimpse of colonial soldiers or Ed Warren-style shadow figures marching through the trees.
Pretty dope.
It's nice of them to, you know, not give up the ceremony. Stand on ceremony and give us the fife and drum if you're going to be marching up the hill.
Fife and life, fife and death, baby.
There's also a translucent white lady carrying a lantern who shows up there sometimes because, like, you're kind of not a haunted site if you don't have a translucent white lady from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the Headless Horseman of Washington Irving and also the Headless Horseman of Canton, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
But there's yet another Headless Horseman that predates Irving's, you know, wild ride with the pumpkin.
Okay, and what's that one?
Well, this relates to one of the underrated badasses of the Revolution, General Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox. By the way, one of Francis Marion's great-great-granddaughters.
Great-great-great-great.
Great-great-great-great. Oh, yeah, she would have.
It was very great.
Yes, it's a lot of greats. That was not enough greats. Came to one of our recent presentations.
And
wasn't that nice, and she...
She is apparently an orb magnet when it comes to like going on ghost tours and stuff in revolutionary related places. So maybe the spirits recognize her DNA as being of Frances Marion's.
Maybe that's because Marion was a war hero. He's a big ghost generator, as we may see in this story.
Now, he's the guy that Mel Gibson in The Patriot is based on?
Yes. He was famous for his kind of hit-and-run guerrilla tactics, which he used to cause all kinds of headaches to General Cornwallis down in the South Theater of the War. So one night, Frances Marion launched a typical daring rescue of a few of his men had been captured by the British. But he heard from, I guess he had a servant girl in the British, in one of the plantations, mm-hmm. who was...
A spy.
That's the word, yes. And she told him there was going to be a party at a nearby plantation, and that all the British officers were going to go, and it was going to be really lightly guarded where his men were. So, perfect place to plan the attack. And when they showed up, just a lone sentry was left behind guarding the prisoners.
It's so typical. Like, everyone who's anyone is going to this party, so just leave one guy behind because we all want to go.
And that guy's like, oh, I'm... You sure you don't need me at that party, guys?
I have a feeling I'm going to feel bad for this guy because he's already down and out.
Oh, it's going to get worse for this guy, yeah. Marion's guerrillas snuck up and apparently, you know, in the story, they sliced this guy's head off before he even knew what was happening. Just, here's a cavalry saber, boop.
Well, at least there's that.
And that was it. They saved their guys and they got out of there. But the following night, at the nearby plantation where the party had been that the British officers had all gone to the night before, a servant reported seeing a headless man stagger up the driveway, blood spurting from his wound before falling down and then vanishing.
Well, that's horrific.
Or, sorry, he didn't vanish. The servant vanished. The servant panicked and fled. And when people came to check, there was nothing there.
How silly do you think the British guys felt coming back and they're all kind of drunk from this party and then they just see this headless guy and none of the prisoners? There's a lot of egg on their face at that point. It's a little awkward.
Fuck. I can't believe you done this.
Oof. Okay. I mean, I feel bad for this guy. Because he was probably just an underling. He didn't even get an invite to the party.
Well, this is not the last time he would show up, though. A few nights later, after that first sighting, the daughter of the plantation owner heard hoofbeats, looked out her window, and saw a man with no head riding up and then climbing off his horse.
This is pretty wild because you don't often, if ever, hear ghost stories that are so immediate after.
Exactly.
Like the night after is crazy.
The man vanished, and ever since, this headless sentry is occasionally reported to this day in the vicinity of Wedgefield Plantation, which you can visit in South Carolina.
Wow.
So
there's a ghost horse, or was a ghost riding a live horse?
That's a great question.
Did they kill the horse?
They didn't. I don't think Frances Marion would have killed the horse.
Maybe they stole the horse.
You'd probably want to steal the horse.
So yeah, how is he riding? Is it a real horse or is it a ghost horse? And if so, where do you get the ghost horse from? Is it kind of like grandfathered in from the afterlife, or to kind of like complete your whole bit?
Yeah, I feel like if you're a ghost, you have a little freedom to. Yes, you've used the perfect terminology. Complete your bit, of course. And maybe you can form some of your ectoplasm into a horse.
I'll have to give it a shot.
That's what I'm going with. But doesn't it seem hard to imagine that Washington Irving didn't hear of either this or the Headless Horseman of Canton or both? Because they were pretty popular stories to pass around at the time.
And both of them are related to the Revolutionary War specifically.
And he was like a amateur historian. He was like an obsessive collector of stories.
Listen, especially back in the day before copyright law and all that, you know, people based things very directly on other things. And, you know, Shakespeare, half of his plays are like based on earlier plays that had already been written. So, you know, it wasn't as big of a thing back then. And if you're writing in that sort of American folk tale theater, you're going to incorporate some real American mythology in there.
Yeah, Irving's a hack. You heard it here first.
Whoa!
We're going to come back in the second part of this episode with some stories of Revolutionary War heroes who have returned to us from beyond the grave. I think you can guess at least one of the names we're going to be talking about.
I'm still shook about Washington Irving.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
We are back, Carrie. In the first half of this show, we covered a few, well, I guess one sort of pre-revolution story, and then we've been talking about revolutionary ghost stories for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And before the break, I teased stories of Revolutionary War heroes who have come back to us from beyond the grave.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems remiss to start any place except with the pride of Mount Vernon himself, George Washington.
G-Wash.
Old G-Wash. You can't have a discussion about colonial ghosts without sparing a few minutes for the father of our country. He is probably the most seen ghost, maybe besides Lincoln.
He's very prolific. He gets around in the afterlife for sure.
And he's all over the place, too.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, Washington was the biggest hero of the new nation when the war ended in 1738. He famously, you know, could have been a king, basically, but returned to his farm instead, wanted to settle down quietly, and then was gracefully pulled back into public service and served his country as president, then decided to voluntarily step down. He's the picture of humble wisdom and restraint, but also bold, decisive action when needed. And he was basically a supernatural, saintly figure in the eyes of Americans by the time he died.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like zero surprise that Americans immediately started seeing George Washington's ghost.
Sure. It's like seeing Elvis at the gas station.
That's right. And notably, he showed up a few times to support troops during the Civil War. Union troops, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, twice within a week, I think.
Listen, he had a to-do list, he had places to be, he had hit a few different locations.
Washington was reported to show up to lend his leadership and moral support, I guess, to Union troops during the 1863 draft riots in Manhattan. This is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a major, major, insane period of rioting and looting in New York in reaction to the draft at the beginning of the war. And apparently, the editors of the New York Times were defending their offices with two Gatling guns.
This is like halfway into the war, right?
Yeah, but there were new levies to refill the Union Army.
Ah, I see.
And Union soldiers were pinned down by demonstrators on Broadway and Duane Street when they supposedly turned to see George Washington dressed in the Army of the Revolution and yelling, "Fix bayonets! Charge!"
So you're saying George Washington backs the blue?
Yeah, I mean, then they charged down the hill toward the protesters and repelled them.
Okay.
But there were some there were some real bad apples in those streets, Gary. It was the New York Times. The reporters are using Gatling guns. You know you're in trouble.
It's like you. Like, I can't imagine that. Defending the offices of News 12.
Just 2 weeks before the draft riots, Washington had also reportedly been seen near the battlefield at Gettysburg.
His ghost must be exhausted.
The 20th Maine Division, you'll remember them, Carrie, as Jeff Daniels' guys in the movie Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually running late on the way to the battle. It's like you and me getting to anything. And they were confused.
Wow.
And they were confused at a fork in the road. Well, except our library presentations, by the way, and live events. Very professional. The men were afraid they were going to be late to the battle, and they were confused at a fork in the road when they turned and saw a tall, imposing figure wearing a tri-corner hat and what appeared to be a Revolutionary War uniform.
And he said, "When you see a fork in the road, take it."
He said, sure, he said exactly that, and he pointed them down the correct road, and I guess led them to Little Round Top, the hill where they would famously, heroically repel the Confederate assault under, again, the command of Jeff Daniels.
Well, Joshua Chamberlain. But did he, or, like, who spread this story?
Chamberlain didn't see this himself, just some of his men told him about it, but he was asked about it later, and I have a quote from him. He said, we know not what mystic power may be possessed by those who are now bivouacking with the dead. I only know the effect, but I dare not explain or deny the cause," because he's saying this after they won the battle, of course. Mm-hmm. "Who shall say that Washington was not among the number of those who aided the country that he founded?"
So he gives a real, sure. Why not?
Maybe. Of course, Carrie, Washington is also reported to haunt Mount Vernon, his 8,000-acre estate in Virginia, which is open for tours to this day. And that's probably the place people most often report seeing our old friend George, which makes sense. Washington lived there, and he died there in bed on December 14th, 1799. And that same old four-poster bed is still sitting in his room all these years later.
Let's hope they changed the mattress.
I'm not sure, honestly. The lucky souls, and I typed a question mark next to the word lucky, but honestly, the lucky souls who have had the...
Lucky souls?
No, but really, like, I would love to... You wouldn't love to spend a night in George Washington's bed? I hope they haven't changed the mattress.
Sure, but I'm a freak.
They people say it's hard to get to sleep in this bed.
Yeah, because it's like Christmas morning. You're so excited. You're in George Washington's bed.
Well, they say they feel the presence of our first president hanging around.
Have they been fucking this ghost?
Yeah, I'm guessing some erotic dreams have been had.
Mm-hmm.
Candles, in addition to the dreams, candles have been reported blowing out.
Oh, yeah. He's like, "Whew, come here, baby."
And people hear whispering voices, or the rattling of an old cavalry saber while they're sleeping in the room.
"You're super sexy. I cannot tell a lie."
Stop being horny for George.
It's funny.
Now, Josiah Quincy III, who is a former mayor of Boston, former president of Harvard, and a congressman. He's the guy who Quincy Market in Boston is named after. So he's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
He confided to his son. We have this from his son's, like, memoirs, and he only says that his dad says that he saw Washington's ghost, and specifically says, "I can't say anymore. I want to check with experts in delusion, like brain delusions."
Well, or maybe he was like, "I don't know what I saw, but I know I had some very erotic dreams."
Well, Quincy, he didn't say there were erotic dreams, so I want to be clear. But he apparently saw Washington's ghost in full person when he stayed in that bed in 1806.
Mm.
Washington's also felt in the stables. Much more recently, a security guard who worked at Mount Vernon through the 80s and 90s said that many times the stable alarm would go off. He would go check it. There would be no one there. And then just a couple of minutes later, the alarm in Washington's bedroom would sound, and it would be about the amount of time it would take to kind of casually stroll from one to the other. But obviously in both places, there'd be no one there.
Yeah, and you get to the room and there's like a ghost George Washington kicked back on the bed, and he's like, ring, 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 ring.
Okay, so horny George is a character now.
Yes.
Ring-a-ding-ding.
Ring-a-ding-ding. Scooby-dooby-doo.
He's a crooner?
Strangers in the night. Soldiers in the night, in his case.
Okay. employees have also reported a ghostly touch, kind of a firm, oh boy. Kind of a firm, comforting presence on the shoulders.
Mm.
Just on the shoulders.
Okay, I said,
While hanging around the so-called yellow room. And the other night someone asked, what's the yellow room?
Well, this is a kid.
but it's a good, it's a valid question.
Yeah, it's a room that's yellow.
It's a room that's yellow. That's, I wish there was more to it, but that's
it wasn't like
is.
The bedroom of a yellow-bellied bastard or something.
Right. Now, George Washington's not the only Revolutionary War hero, not the only Revolutionary War general that people report seeing as a ghost after his death. The lesser-known hero, Mad Anthony Wayne, didn't have the pleasure of dying in bed. He succumbed to gout on a trip home from a military posting in Detroit in 1896.
Ugh, succumbing to gout just sounds terrible.
It's the disease of kings.
Okay, so it's inbreeding.
Wayne was known for his bold, aggressive, quote-unquote, mad tactics in battle, hence the name Mad Anthony Wayne. He loved a bayonet charge, you know? Why shoot when a bayonet charge will do, Anthony Wayne would say. That's not a direct quote. After he died, on the road, his men buried him near where he died. It was near a fort not far from Erie, Pennsylvania. But Wayne's family wanted him returned to the family plot at home, and 13 years later, his son came to get him. It's a good son. So he dug up Dad, and even though 13 years had passed, he found the body curiously undecomposed. He was, I guess, expecting, maybe even hoping for, but certainly expecting a skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of what he was prepared to transport back.
But he was still chunky.
He was still a full, connected body.
That's crazy.
It is. And so what he had to do was find some locals to help him saw his father up.
Did he have to do this?
Put him in a big old pot and boil him down until he was nothing but bones.
I don't think he had to do this.
Well, listen, if you've got like a footlocker and you need to stuff your dad inside of it.
Get a bigger coffin? Instead of boiling and chopping up your dad like he's a bunch of old vegetables to make soup?
Oh, sorry, Carrie. You're right. It didn't work. Oh, wait.
Okay, keep going with the story. Where does the ghost come in, hmm?
Okay. Okay, you've got a point there. Legend does have it that he, Wayne's son, that is, didn't secure the box maybe super well.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he got home, yes, a few of his dad's bones had bounced out along the way.
So you lost a few loosies.
A few loose bones left.
Imagine
along the
being
side
that son. You know, you get there and you're like, ooh, yikes.
Well, it probably only happens after some counting. You know what I mean? Unless it's like...
No, unless like there's unless like half like a leg hanging off of out of like a hole.
Unless it's a shin or like a skull that you're missing, you might have to count those things up. You're going 201, 202, 203!
A whole foot that just kind of clattered out there. You're getting a lot of little toe bones that are just scattered behind you like breadcrumbs.
I've only got 203. That can't be right. Count them again. We're missing a phalange somewhere.
Mm.
So it is, I think this is really funny and also more than a little sad that supposedly General Wayne is seen from time to time wandering on the shoulder of U.S. Route 322 in Pennsylvania, which is the route that his son took home, searching forlornly for his lost bones.
That's a big oopsie-daisy on the son's part, you know? He's probably like a messy kind of forgetful guy in life. And then in death, you lose a bunch of your dad's bones and he becomes a lumbering ghost bound to the world forever. It's a big...
There, but for the grace of God, go I.
Oh, we're not there yet. Who knows? You still have time.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
No news this week. We just want to wish everyone a lovely, safe, and spooktacular Halloween.
Boo.
Boo.
We'll certainly have one. As I told you, listener, Carrie's been stocking up on king-size candy bars. We're going to be the best house on the block.
Yeah. We have some outdoor decorations, certainly indoor decorations. No, we do not have the 12-foot skeleton. I wish we had the 12-foot skeleton.
We have an HOA instead.
Yeah, our house is weird. But we're really excited for our first house Halloween, excited for trick-or-treaters, and excited for our first Halloween party at our new house, which is going to function as a housewarming for a lot of our friends who haven't seen it since either we first moved in and, you know, we've done a lot of projects since then or at all.
You've set the bar pretty high in past years, Carrie. What are some of the highlights of the Halloween party traditionally?
Well, I mean, the biggie there is we have a costume contest every year. So that is... you're going to have an overall winner, of course, and you could win multiple things. There's male and female. Now, these are just presenting costumes. So if a guy was in drag or something, he could win best female. Then there's sex.
I didn't realize that, actually.
Yes. We just really haven't had that.
If a man who identified as a man came in drag, I would vote for him and it was great, I would vote for him for best male costume.
No, it's the same thing as if a man who identifies as a man dresses as a woman on Drag Race, that you refer to the drag queen as she.
I'm going to have to think about this hard.
Okay, well, it's literally never been a factor at our parties. But we have those. We have sexiest, funniest, scariest, and best couple. And everyone gets a little prize. Who wins those? Everyone votes. We have a trivia contest. We have pumpkin pong. So this is our beer pong tournament where you can possibly win the golden pumpkin trophy, which I hand paint every year. Let's see. We have
we have enough space this year that we might have a secondary table for filthy casuals who don't like the pressure of the competition.
Of course. We have a whole variety of themed foods and drinks and shots. I always have some jello shots, some pudding shots, some syringe shots. And there's plenty of options for our non-drinking friends as well.
You rattled those off like they were normal types of shots. Jello shots, people know.
So pudding shots are basically jello shots, but pudding.
Pumpkin pudding.
Yes. And the syringe shots are in those big plastic shot syringes. And they're usually like a more liquidy version of a jello shot.
Right.
And I like to go around with my little tray and I hand them out. Everyone gets very happy. Let's see, there's music. I just have a lot of fun. It's a very stressful time because I really want everyone to have a great time. But everyone seems to really enjoy themselves. And that's kind of the reason for the season for me. It's a time where everyone can get together and be spooky and have fun. And there's not any other kind of element to it. Like Christmas kind of has a lot of family stuff going on. There's possibly religious elements and the gifts and all that stuff. But Halloween, you know, it, and I love Christmas, but Halloween is kind of there just for the fun of it to me.
Well, it might change when we have kids, but
oh, yeah. Well, then that's going to be like, oh, now we have to bring them to trunk or treat. Now they want to blah, 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 blah. But that'll just be a new fun thing to enjoy. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it all. I'm really excited. I hope we have a nice Halloween where it's not like a blizzard like some years or sweltering hot like others. You never know with Connecticut Halloweens. But yeah, I hope everyone else's week is spooky and fun. And you get some leaf peeping in. I think we're hitting peak leaf over here in Connecticut.
Yeah, we went to Vermont during peak, and then we brought it back with us. Very exciting.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome, East Coast. So yeah, I hope everyone has a great Halloween time. We'll be back just after Halloween. I think, what, the 2nd of November is our next episode. And, you know, I might come back sounding decidedly less chipper. I think our first post-Halloween episode was The Real Candyman, where I was talking after being so sad that Halloween was over. So, yeah, I may be in a period of mourning when you hear me next.
Yeah, you get seasonal affective disorder, but starting November 1st.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sad, but it's spooky affective disorder. So, I hope everyone has a wonderful, wonderful time. It's been a blast getting to meet some of you and meet more of you over our presentation period. And, yeah. Can't wait to see what happens next with the podcast.
I have a feeling it'll involve all of you. So thanks.
Hopefully listening at the very least. That's it for this episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ain't It Scary, and check out our website at ain'titscary.com. You can support the show by supporting our sponsors and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/ain'titscary. Don't forget to share your favorite moments of the last 50 or so episodes with us, either via email at ain'titscary@gmail.com, any of the social medias I just mentioned, or you can call and leave a message at our Google Voice number, 203-666-5529. We might share your favorite clip from the last 50 episodes on a compilation show to come up shortly. And please subscribe to the show and throw us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and also on Spotify. We'll be forever grateful.
We certainly will. And special thanks to those of you already members of our little Patreon family, our little spooky family over here. Sean O'Donnell, Jared Chamberlain, Maria Ferrante, Robin McCabe, Comfy Mike, Alex Nakutis, Ryan Regan, Christy Atchison, Kate Pope, Haley, Ryan, Enrique, and Ira. We love you all very much. Everyone I just mentioned by name is absolutely invited to our Halloween party if you can make it.
And thanks, Alex, for sharing a very interesting article with us on Twitter. Some stories possibly that we'll be covering
on X, please.
Yeah, we love when you guys share prospective stories with us, things that you'd like us to cover, so go for that. And we'd love to see it. See you next Thursday.
Show created by Sean and Carrie McCabe, music by Kyle Ryan. You can find Kyle at his YouTube channel, Music is a Verb.
Ain't It Scary has been brought to you by Killer Podcasts and is a production of Longboy Media.
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to The Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.